Fascinating Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're continuing our ongoing conversations about the culture of consciousness, the cultures of consciousness. And one of the things I've been thinking about lately is this curious pressure I think we feel right now with the degree of invasion and integration of our everyday lives and the internet, of a curious kind of tension. And on the one hand, there's the sense that to make our online existences, our lives in general, more sane, is that we need more transparency and clear identity as we move through information space. That means we need to be honest about who we are and what we're doing. And if people are traceable, if you can identify them, that we will be able to have higher standards of behavior. So, for example, trolling would be something that would become difficult to do if you could be identified. All sorts of problems with a security, money, et cetera, would be solved in this direction. And at the same time, I think many of us feel, even more than ever, the desire to hide, to dissimulate, to leave random noise in our trail, to disguise ourselves from whatever any number of forces who are trying to identify us and pin us down. The very sense that every move we make online is being tracked is deeply disturbing before you even begin to think of the political and other possibilities that could arise from such a situation. And so it's almost like there's this weird desire to both authenticate and disguise the self in this new environment. And I'm not sure how those two things are going to go well together. And I certainly feel myself leaning towards the latter. But some of these questions were really stirred up by the reading I was doing for today's guests. We're lucky to have Mackenzie Warg here. He is a professor at the New School, and his last couple books have been about the Situationist International and their influence and continuing reverberations as we face the kinds of very peculiar questions that are brought up by the information society as it reformulates and invades the very fabric of our dreams and desires. And Mackenzie has been on the media theory, media activist beat for quite a long time. He and I both participated in a wonderful space that still exists, but it really had its heyday in the 1990s, called NetTime, which was a listserv full of media artists, activists, hackers, anarchists, very, very smart people. And it was a remarkable space because it neither gave in to naive techno-utopianism, the kinds of exuberant ideas that were sort of laid the groundwork for the commodification and sort of overwhelming ideology that we can associate with the large-scale forces of computer technology, with the big companies, with Google and Apple, the smiley face on the growing surveillance society. And at the same time, NetTime refused all manner of nostalgias, of desires for retreat and a neo-Luddite resistance. And it's left me, in any case, with a strong sense of maintaining the critical edge in our relationship with technology without believing that there's some simple way to turn it off, to go back, to cool out. And a lot of that spirit I find in his ongoing work. So I look forward to talking about the Situationist International and other media-related items. Mackenzie, thanks so much for joining me on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's really fun to hear your voice. I've just been, chatting with you and following your stuff for such a long time, and I'm really happy you have decided to turn your critical eyes more recently on the heritage of the situation is international, and all the various cohorts and characters under that umbrella. But I thought we'd start out maybe just talking about what is the spectacle and what's happened to it since it was identified as such that leaves us in the situation that you call the spectacle of disintegration.
Yeah, the situations international were identified with this kind of critique of what had happened to the capitalism around the middle of the 20th century, that it had become spectacular, that there was a sort of doubling of the sort of relations of capitalist production in a sort of spectacular relations, which at that time meant really cinema and then television. And the spectacle is a place where that which is good appears and that which appears is good. You know, this sense of a sort of phantasmal secondary world that both offers a set of desires but limits them also to things that you can, you know, stamp out as commodities. But that doesn't really kind of quite describe where we find ourselves now. And there was a lot of enthusiasm about the internet as making that go away. But maybe what it did was really just break it up into small pieces. So we're all carrying a tiny little spectacular double around with us, you know, to look at on our little pad or our little phone. So maybe we just sort of broke it up and we all have this sort of like limited repertoire of desires mirrored back to us purely in the form of things that you can turn into a commodity you can buy.
Yeah, so what it reminds me of when you talk about the original idea of the spectacle, the spectacle is kind of the place where we fall into the sort of hoodwink of desires in consumer capitalism, where we see something, our desire is elicit, the natural, or whatever you want to call it, emerging human juice, and it gets captured by this possibility, and yet the actual purchase of the commodity, the actual engagement with it, is always sort of a letdown, which then in turn returns us to the spectacle as this kind of constantly frustrated sight that then can be used in other ways with more direct kind of political machinations and engineering of social ideas. But it's that basic sort of mechanism of desiring a spectacular life, which we then can no longer really realize in our actual life. Would you say that's kind of a...
Yeah, one of the sort of submerged themes in Situations writing was about boredom and how, you know, in some ways the great danger for this commodified universe is our boredom with it. But, you know, every now and then we're just sort of like, as Peggy Lee famously sang, isn't that all there is? You know, I can get another app, like, that's it, that's all you got. So it's kind of constantly hysterically nervous about that gap, trying to sort of throw more stuff at us. If you watched any children's animation cinema of the last few years, it's just kind of hysterically frightened of boredom. You know, you have to kind of like throw stuff at the screen constantly, which is itself also then kind of hyper-boring in a way. So there was this sort of dialectic that you could tease out that even, you know, in this kind of overdeveloped late capitalist world, that boredom was still this kind of critical energy that you could work on and try to sort of firstly theorize and then act on to find other kinds of belonging, other kinds of desire, other kinds of life.
Do you think that's, I mean, it seems like that's harder to do except at an almost baseline level of just utter fatigue with the process. I mean, I don't know whether it's partly, getting older, but just the phenomenon of the forced upgrade, you know, itself, I come to see this increasing feeling of dread, resentment, and irritation, which basically has within it a certain kind of boredom, where the labor is forced on me to, you know, continue to do the things that I do and perhaps get, quote-unquote, certain improvements. The imposition of it is just, you know, produces this moment of just, like, kind of horror. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm clearly, like, falling out of the excitement that I once had with the crazy overproduction of digital commodities and apps and processes. And for a while, it was just sort of a fascinating thing for me. And as I find myself increasingly unable to find it juicy, to find it even a kind of good distraction. And so I think a lot about boredom, and I recognize that behind it, sort of in the cracks of people's accounts of their lives, you can hear this kind of, but it's not really, it's like when I think of boredom, I think of being like, you know, that kind of productive boredom that's, or not productive, but just sort of interesting boredom when you're like 10 years old and it's a Sunday afternoon and there's sort of nothing to do but everything to do, and then you find your way towards some other kind of thing. But this kind of boredom is much more constrained somehow. It's hard to put my finger on it, but I sense it in social space quite a lot.
Well, you know, we're relentlessly told now about how innovative and disruptive everything is. And the fact that you have to keep insisting on both those words means that both are utterly untrue. This is an age of absolute stasis. This isn't innovation at all. And nothing is disruptive. It's just more of the same over and over again, just little variations on something. You know, so it's a great age of non-change.
And it's really important to trumpet that message. It reminds me, recently there was a pretty good Tom Frank rant, you know, cranky rant, and so I think sometimes he can be really right on it, and not so much other times. But this one was pretty good, and he went and he read a bunch of creativity literature, and it's the same kind of stuff, this innovation, disruptive, you know, this engine of creativity. He went through and he read all these creativity books, but they all say the same thing. They use the same...
Yeah.
You know, the same examples. It's, and then you just get the sense of the wheels just you know, spinning in this kind of mud.
I mean, if you were a person who really made interesting music or writing or code, why would you read a book about creativity? Like, the last thing you frickin' do, you're just going and making your thing and hanging out with your people who you know who appreciate that and also do the same thing. Yeah, so, I mean, all of those words, you know, innovation and disruption and creativity, this is the suit speaking, you know, this is like the language of accountants. It's not for us.
So what does the, so I'm, we're in this situation, there's so many peculiar difficulties to it. What do these crazy characters from, you know, 50, 40, 30 years ago, what do they say to us? What makes these stories worth bringing forward? And because you don't just talk about the main, for people who know about situationism, you don't just talk about the main characters and their ideas, but you follow lots of, in the last two books, all these interesting stories of all sorts of characters with different interpretations, different kinds of expressions, different kinds of actions.
Mm-hmm.
But what is it about the whole, the network of ideas and practices that are stirred up by these guys that seem pressing to you today?
Yeah, you know, people who know about the Situationist International think it's really about Geeta Board's book, Society as a Spectacle, which is indeed a quite extraordinary book that I recommend. But there are all these other characters with all sorts of other really interesting politico-aesthetic practices going on, like, you know, Asger Jorn thinking about, you know, who are the form makers? Can artists think of themselves as the form makers rather than the content makers of the world? Or Constant Neumann, who's, you know, trying to imagine a kind of utopian global infrastructure, you know, like, can we dream on that scale again? That struck me as kind of interesting. Or that they cross paths with Alexander Trocky, you know, who's kind of inventing blogging, you know, on Ronio machines in the 60s. So I just sort of wanted to retell this story and put some of these characters back in and put the women back in the story. Sheryl Bernstein's, you know, wonderful writings about love and sex as a kind of a strategic game, but which one that's not played cynically in the way that it sort of is now. So I thought this was worth reinvestigating as sort of ways forward, because it's, as you were saying before, it's not blood-eyed or nostalgic or wanting to go back to some romantic past. You know, they're fully accepting of the reality of the capitalism of their era. And, you know, we can do the same. You know, you can learn from these examples of how to not think longingly of something else, but how to think tactically about, well, what can we actually do that would be, you know, kind of aesthetically interesting and challenging, and would articulate a new mode of desire and new mode of living right here and now.
Well, one of the elements of their aesthetic practices that seem very relevant and that people will sort of recognize the basic logic of is this idea of détournement. And to determine something is to, as far as I would define it, you know, take some pre-existing chunk out of the spectacle, out of ordinary commodity cultures, and then make a shift, essentially remix it, add some material, juxtapose some of these items in order to produce something of interest, of insight, and of even politically productive kinds of energies. And looking at some of the ways that the Situationists did this, de Boer did it with his own texts in terms of appropriating other material and sort of playing games with that, and he did it very strongly with his wonderful, you know, bizarre, interesting films, where you have all these kind of clips from training films and commercial films, and he's, you know, his theoretical material and political perspectives are putting over this material. So we go, oh yeah, it's remix culture. It's the cut up. It's the mash up. So we recognize the formal logic, but there's also some ways in which we can't make too easy a connection between what they meant by détournement and what we would think of as sort of remix culture. So I'd love to hear you sort of try to define the difference almost, because they're clearly related, but there's something else going on that seems really key.
Yeah, I mean, the French word détournement, it's related to our English word detour, you know, to sort of turn aside. It also has the sense of hijacking and seduction, you know, a kind of a turning aside. You know, if you can sort of think all of those things together. And, you know, they're very, very prescient about, you know, first, the culture is always collectively made. It's kind of a myth that great individuals make it. It's always collectively made. And we know a lot more now about the invisible people that make everything possible. But that it could be intentionally collectively made. Or in other words, the private property in culture and information could go away. And I think they're really ahead of their time in discovering that. So this would become a whole social movement, that a lot of people all over the planet would go, culture belongs to everybody, let's share it. You know, I'm putting out everything I've got on a BitTorrent, here it is. And you take it up and you can remix it and do whatever you like with it, but it's to sort of go a little bit further than that and to see it as a kind of abolition of private property in at least one domain. And then you can ask, well, maybe we could do it in other domains. What would the commons be in other areas of life if we can intentionally, collectively produce culture? Maybe we can intentionally, collectively produce other parts of our lives as well.
Yeah, it's a very inspiring sight. And I'm kind of curious. I mean, I think that, like, when you wrote the Hacker Manifesto, where you really, you know, about it came out about almost a decade ago, you know, that the copyright wars, the intellectual property wars, the dialogue around intellectual property was at that point, it's, you know, still is incredibly important, but I think that was a particularly ripe time for it, because people could see the sort of potential for another world on top of the kind of, you know, brute reality of people just wanting free music, and, you know, it's a complicated mixture of motivations. And I'm kind of curious how you see that dialogue now. Like, I mean, it's not the sort of, even though the issues remain incredibly important, it doesn't seem to have quite the sort of resonance that it did at that point, in terms of being a site of another way of doing things. I could be wrong.
Well,
I'm kind of curious how you see that playing into more contemporary debates.
We won. I mean, it's, you know, let's celebrate the fact that we won. Everybody just basically had to acknowledge that culture can be free. And the whole of the culture industry is slowly reorganizing around that fact. Now, of course, they're trying extreme forms of legal persecution that's being decided through international treaty outside of any democratic oversight or control whatsoever. But that's really a sign of the fact that we won, that everybody thinks, you know, at least some part of culture should belong to everyone. I'm going to decide what I'm going to pay for. I'm not going to assume that something was made, you know, 50 years ago by a bunch of people who never even saw a dollar from it is some corporation's property. You know, like, no one buys that anymore. But there's a sort of reorganization of how to commodify culture, having won the commons. So there's, if you like, another battle, and we're sort of a bit behind in that one. And that's where the front line kind of moves to. And it's like, oh, okay, so culture of the commons, or is there a way to commodify the commons rather
yeah.
than commodify every single bit of the property of it?
Or commodify the access to it. So it's the way
yeah.
that, you know, Google doesn't care who owns the information that you're downloading or accessing so much as it just wants to be able to own the space within which you access that, and then can turn that fact or that bit of data into you know, into part of the you know, the revenue stream. So you become tracked and commodified through your actions, not through the ownership or lack of ownership of the data you're accessing. But that other space, that sort of access space, that ownership of the commons thing, it's difficult to imagine. It's harder to get, like, the copyright stuff, you can sort of, you know, it doesn't require that much to kind of get the basic sort of situation and to understand the consequences, at least immediately, of owning or sharing and the difference between those. But I find our current situation, in the sense of where the sort of larger scale power grab is difficult to get our hands around, because it's already in the place where we're trying to figure out what's going on. So
one way to think about it is, you know, we won that one. Okay, data can be free. Metadata is not. You know, metadata is private property. You know, in other words, anything that you could extract out of that data about its provenance, about how, you know, elements in the archive can be mined and so forth. So, you know, like the data punks won the first round, but now you need metapunks who can, like, take on, you know, the next layer, if you like, of that kind of conflict and sort of free up some space within that. I think that's where the front line moves to, in a sense. There will, of course, also be rearguard actions where people are going to go to jail for sharing the culture that belongs to all of us and that we all collectively make, you know. And that's a tragedy. So there's sort of all sorts of legal persecution hemming in the edges. But I think the overall kind of design is to sort of move up to the next level. So you get a kind of hyper-corporate structure that really can't be bothered making or growing anything anymore. It's just going to kind of like control the flow of data and what value can be extracted from it.
Yeah, and so I'm kind of curious how you when you look at the legacy of the situationists, is it more a kind of to stir up a sort of sense of how to be inside the belly of the beast but make moves kind of against it to open up space as a possibility of engendering new ways of doing things, of recovering certain basic human experiences in the midst of this kind of thing? Is it close or far? Are they giving us concrete tools and techniques and practices, or is it more of a almost kind of, you know, spiritual legacy of people who have been doing this that should be sort of whose memories can resonate and in turn inspire us now?
It's a little bit of both, and just to mention one of their other great discoveries is the reef, you know, the drift. You know, can you kind of wander through urban space independent of, you know, work hours and leisure hours, you know, just not work, and wander through it and just sort of experience ambiences that give you a glimpse of another city, And you could then imagine rebuilding the whole city around its kind of special, particular ambiences and moments. And that is a real practice that you can do, and it gives you a sense of how you could improve everyday life. You know, it's a real thing that works. They were already doing it in this massively policed, gentrified, tourist-filled kind of city that was Paris in the mid-50s. You know, so it's not as if this city is some fallen version of some great past city. You know, they're already living in the kind of city we're in now, where the rents were too high and there's tourists everywhere and yuppies and hipsters and whatever. You know, they're trying to like find a way that you could extract sort of utopian moments out of that. So yes, on the one hand, there's actual particular things that they did, and it's worth learning them, for some of them still work. But it's not to get stuck in the past too much. It's more to just take it as an example that we can be an avant-garde all over again.
Right.
You know, how can we practice a kind of joyous, creative life together in the margins of this and not beat ourselves up about the fact that, of course, we're going to fail, but we will fail better.
Yeah.
We will ourselves, the other thing about the situation is the attempt is itself glorious, you know?
The attempt what?
Is itself glorious.
Right.
You know, to that life should be a little bit of an adventure, you know?
What's an example of a derive that you've really gotten a lot out of, like personally?
They've always been with particular people. I had a wonderful wander around Amsterdam with Geert Lovink, who's another net timer, who I'm sure you would know.
Sure, sure.
Or around London with Trevor Schultz. And you know, it's... There's different versions of it. You can do it in a group. You can do it. It's best to do it with at least one other person. It's my kind of preferred mode. And you just, you know, in these sort of like interstitial parts of the city, I mean, you think London is, you know, they didn't gentrify neighborhoods. They gentrified the entire city. But you could find these like little fallow zones where people are just kind of carving out some other way of life where you can kind of traverse it in an interesting way. You know, it's always kind of in between the well-known bits. So I still find that kind of experience useful.
It's interesting you mentioned how it's sort of, in my experience also, I mean, a solo walk has its own zone and you can turn it into a derive, but it seems there's something about relating to others and the way that people have different maps or degrees of knowledge about a city space. And there's somewhere between the kind of, especially like I've had the experience like that sounds like you have of being with people who know cities better than you do.
Yeah.
And yet something happens by the both of you being together where further marvels are opened up and their eyes see things they haven't seen before. I mean that other fantastic city is always just a turn away. What else?
And,
we've talked about
determinant. Say
again?
We're building cities on a whole new scale, so it helps to sort of extract the useful parts of the scale it's already at to think about what it's going to be like when we sort of scale it up.
Yeah, it's remarkable thinking about the mega cities that already exist, let alone the ones around the corner. I mean, I live in San Francisco, which is this most that I would sort of place as the first genuinely gentrified city, and it's so small, so it the way that it kind of it elaborates itself is very dense and kind of virtual through a lot of that's where a lot of the kind of the hipster energies go, because there's just not that many spaces anymore that have that that chaotic quality where you don't know what's exactly happening.
Yeah, you know, I went on a tour of the Google headquarters here in New York City, and it's like a domesticated version of this. It's all kind of twisty, and it's not laid out in a queer way, and there's like little separate ambiences and rooms and things and all these signs of what play is supposed to be about. But you don't see anybody playing, you know. You don't see anybody borrowing the scooters to zip around. But it's all been kind of enclosed and reappropriated. So that side of this is true also, that you know, avant-garde techniques have their time. And as Du Bois said, you know, the avant-garde's, you know, they're defeated in their turn, and we regroup, and on you go.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we're going to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Mackenzie Wark about the spectacle of disintegration and other matters, mediatic, and we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis, and we're talking with Mackenzie Wark about matters, media. You wrote a book about games and gaming culture a while ago, and I'm kind of interested in hearing your some reflections on how things have changed since that time, or how you see the continuing effects of gamification, and just to put a little spin on, particularly in terms of this question of play. I'm really interested in play as a motivating factor in social relations, play as a way to dodge simple consumerism, play as a place where we can get glimpses of another possible world, and that world of play is sort of interwoven, though not exactly identified, with the world of games, and particularly the intense gamification of networks, the multiplication of games and opportunity to play games, and the way in which the game has become a kind of model for all sorts of interactions, ways of accessing information, ways of relating to other people in other situations. So I just love to hear you riff a little bit on how you see the game continuing to play today.
Yeah, I mean, these two books I wrote about the situationists, they're sort of like prequels to books I wrote, you know, a little bit earlier, which was Hacker Manifesto and then Gamer Theory, which were about, you know, what became of tournament and also play, which were great situationist themes. And Gamer Theory is a little bit about to be cautious of how much play kind of got recuperated. And that what's interesting about, call it what you like, you know, late capitalism, is the way it found ways to kind of commodify non-labor. Play is supposed to be outside the framework of what you can commodify, but it actually isn't anymore. And you know, ways to make a living off people not working is kind of where we are now. And Gamer Theory is about, okay, well, if this is sort of the reality, the word gamification hadn't been invented, so I called it game space, that everything's become a kind of game space, that everybody's trying to, come up with some moves and figure out the rules and find some way to game every aspect of their life. So you can rate your lovers on certain websites, you can try to game your resume so that you can play the job game, there's the real estate game, you know, everything became kind of game-like. So there's a way in which things like actual computer games are almost like a utopian version of that everyday life, because it's where the sort of mystical promises of our time are actually kept. In a computer game, you know, the playing field really is level for once, whereas we kind of all experience that's not really true in the game space of, you know, the actual world where we're obliged to play. So in that book, I was trying to, on the one hand, acknowledge that there's a sense in which play gets folded into these money-making schemes, but on the other hand, you could kind of think of the utopian side of play is still trapped in there as well. One can stress that side of it.
So do you find it that it sounds like, I guess like everything, that play is at once something that is being very much drawn into the modes of late capitalism, but it still seems to be a place where some of that joy and some of the possibility of generating productive and interesting desires can take place. Mm. So,
oh yes, all that I think is still true. Yeah,
and so
all
I mean,
those
just like
together is the challenge, right? Is we always want something that's like a pure inside versus a pure outside, and it's never the case. There's always the sort of the interplay in between. So it's to think at one and the same time that, well, of course, play gets kind of co-opted and made functional for capital and all that, but never completely. Like, there's always another aspect of it that you can, where you kind of tug against those kind of forces and invent another life. So it's to not want anything too pure is part of the necessary act of thinking these things.
Well, one of the things that I like about your work, and I would characterize it as a kind of playfulness, is that the last handful of books you put out, they're never quite normal books. You know, they've always got some link to some expanded field. So the game theory, you know, locks into this whole sort of online range of possible reactions to the book, extensions of the book, and then your last two books on Situationist, the cover unfolds into this kind of wonderful, you know, graphic map, and I can sort of sense you playing with the form of the book or the form of the, you know, the scholar who has an expertise in a certain area and trying to kind of bring it out, and then with the spectacle of disintegration, you went so far as to create an action figure. Tell me about the action
yeah.
figure associated with this book.
I think, you know, being a critical theorist has an aesthetic dimension, and like a book should be a total work of art, including a kind of performative dimension. So I thought, well, what's d'Tournement in the 21st century? And I thought 3D printing, and it's not to buy into the sort of magical sense of that is going to change the world and all that, but it's just a way things can be made in three dimensions rather than two. So I thought, well, I'll get a real toy designer to make me a Geeta board action figure, and then I'll make some, which will never be for sale. I'll just give them away to very special people. Michelle Bernstein has the first one, who is Geeta board's widow. And then we'll make the STL file to make your own, so anybody can make their own Geeta board figure. And then people start to do d'Tournements of them. So they cross them with, like, manga figures and stuff like that. And I sort of thought, well, it gets it out of the, you know, we think of d'Tournement as being about, you know, video and sound and things like that. Well, let's get it into the third dimension of making actual things. And this turned out to be controversial. And, you know, it's kind of misunderstood. But you know, people are making them, and I'm kind of really happy with that. Although I've been criticized by people who really collect these things because it's not really an action figure because it doesn't move. Like, it's not posable. So I keep, you know, people ask me, what's his action? And I have different answers.
He's thinking.
His action is smoking. His action is theory. His action is revolution. Like, take your pick. You know, you have whichever one you want. But the figure itself doesn't move.
Well, what I love about I like about action figures and vinyl toys. I was really into the kind of explosion of Asian vinyl toys around a decade ago, and they're into this kind of interaction with hip hop aesthetics and street culture, and then these objects. And what was so funny about them is because they were so expressive of a certain kind of moment, because production processes had changed such that it was now economical to make very small runs of figures. So they were able to make limited markets so they could have these kind of special, you know, there's only 200, there's only 150 of the ones that have the red hats and the ones with the blue hats or a larger run, so they're not as expensive. So they created this whole sort of market of desire for the rare thing, for the collectible, for the cool. You know, and some of them had cool, you know, juxtapositions of traditional figures and science fiction, and there was a cleverness to a lot of these things. But what was weird is that, like, kind of the whole thing about owning them was like it's so clearly a concept. It almost exists in the virtual, and yet we have these machines that can actualize them into three-dimensional objects that then become valuable. But they always had the virtual trace. You know, it's always like you just sort of, you had a CAD design that popped into reality. And when I saw the DeBoer figure, I had a similar sense of, like, this kind of, you know, the sort of absurdity of it becoming a physical object, and yet there's this sort of playfulness that puts thought back into the process. So I was actually really interested that people were kind of bummed out about it. I didn't quite follow the grumpiness. Did they feel like you're sort of a, dare I say it, a sellout by, you know, sort of reproducing a certain kind of trivial toy in light of this, or what's the problem?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm a really bad Marxist, I have to admit. I'm just not with the dogmatic program with all this stuff, but I'm really fascinated by how things actually get made, you know, like what's the mode of production. It was part of my reason to do it. But it turns out you're not supposed to know about those things, this actual making. But there, it confused people. It's a thing, but it's not really a commodity because you're not selling it.
Yeah.
It's not for sale. And but on the other hand, the information about how to make it is free. You know, it's deliberately Creative Commons licensed. It's, you know, you can look it up. You can go download it, go print it yourself. So that this extends into physical objects kind of confused people. And also, you know, somehow people imagine that the board is against the image and the visual. It's not true. I mean, the spectacle doesn't just mean the visual. It means a kind of social relation mediated by commodified culture, if you like, of which the image is an avatar, but it's not just that. He made films. He's very, very interested in you know, the visual repertoire, if you like, and how it can be made critical. So I thought, well, can I introduce, you know, the Debord figure into that world you were describing, the sort of specialty toy for grown-up kind of world and the whole production system that it hints at as now being a realm of possibility. And the way that the only thing that gives this lump of plastic any real value at all is a sort of symbolic universe. But I'm just sort of connecting it to a different one. It's not a manga character. It's a theory character. You know, what does that mean? It just struck me as, like, what you might call not conceptual art, but conceptual design. Like, it struck me it was worth trying to press on that and see what happened. And when you do press on these things, certain people freak out. But that's fun, yeah? That's the game.
Yeah, it seems fun. Well, I'm curious what other, since you do have this quality of enjoying the making process and trying to include that as a vector of what can be a very abstract life of dealing with words and concepts and theories and teaching and writing and reading, and you enjoy the sort of vector of making. How do you reflect on the sort of maker culture, for lack of a better term, which we can see already, you know, certainly, obviously, is commodified in all sorts of remarkable and sometimes very tedious ways, the fetish for the local, for the artisanal, often expensive, a whole, you know, in the way that it weaves into these pockets of hipsterdom which overlap, you know, information technology in all sorts of interesting ways. But obviously, there's something really remarkable there as well. I mean, just the choice people are making to make rather than consume at any given kind of point, and the sort of, you know, cultural possibilities that's opened up. And we've, you know, it's been going now for a number of years. And, you know, I'm here in the Bay Area, you're in there in New York. We've seen it all around. It kind of transforms space. Things open up. How would you reflect on maker culture now? Is it in danger of getting too cutesified? Is there some real energy there? How do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that ship has sailed. I mean, I take my kids to Maker Faire every year, and they love it. You know, my son plays with knitting machines, and my daughter learns to solder. I like the way it at least a little bit crosses the gender divide between different kinds of making. But of course, they're trying to sell you a whole bunch of stuff. You know, it's been commodity. It's like, you know, home hobby culture rebranded in a way. But, you know, this is the thing. I'm always trying to see the ambivalent, ambiguous side of these things. Isn't it a good thing for people to learn how things actually work and what processes of making actually are? And some of these do indeed scale. You know, some of it's stuff that would only happen in your garage, but some of these are keys to processes to kind of understand how the world itself is actually made. And that's a good education, I think, to understand the production process of our time.
So, well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a really it's a really important element in even just thinking about the legacy of Marxism and how, you know, what elements of that are still absolutely necessary for how we think about the world. And it seems like one of the problems is that even before we talk about labor and what labor is that you have to start knowing about how things are made through actual labor processes. And it's so easy, if you're not paying attention, to just sort of take all of these processes and objects as givens, and that's almost what they want. And so to be able to open up a space where we're paying attention, you're practicing the body, you understand how, you know, disciplines of the body connect with machines and go, enter into chains of processes, that seems really, very, very necessary as well.
I mean, here's why I'm a bad Marxist. You know, like, you're supposed to read Marx's notebooks through the bit where he talks about famous philosophers or famous economists, but I like the bits where he's trying to draw steam engines. Like, he really did that. He tried to figure out how a steam engine worked because that was the engine of production of his time. And it also, you realize we've got to rethink this capitalism thing because it ain't about steam engines anymore. Boy, did it move on. So how do you repeat that gesture of have this kind of admittedly amateur knowledge? I'm not an engineer, but I kind of want to at least have a conceptual grasp of how technologies work and what they do. And to me, that's the Marxist bit, is to do that, but also in a kind of a playful and engaged kind of way. Those seem to be sort of versions of that legacy to try to recuperate and extend and redevelop.
So how are you developing those kinds of ideas and moves now? Like when you think about the sort of the maker side of things, the understanding how things work, you're a media theorist, you produce texts, you're a teacher. What are some ways that you see to kind of keep the kind of critical language alive, even as it has to wrestle with these emerging situations, with new technologies, new kind of like social conditions that are produced through these technological environments? How do you keep your how do you draw that steam engine today?
I mean, it's obviously not something any one individual could actually do, but I think part of it is to move away from, you know, the critique of politics and media and that sort of thing, and towards design. I mean, that strikes me as a really interesting domain, and there are interesting people doing it and thinking it, but not very many. You know, it's people who reflect really an interesting, creative, and critical way on that is a small crowd. So I think there's more to do on that because it's sort of interstitial. It's more relevant than art is, and dare I say, perhaps even politics. That, you know, the modes of living are designed before they're anything in this century. So that strikes me as an area to kind of to sort of dig in and try to figure out how the world is produced.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the concept of design, in particular of what has now become a term, experience design. And I played with that concept, like, you know, 15 years ago in some essay. I was like playing with the notion of how you actually like engineer phenomenological experience of consciousness and da da da, and watched as it became like a term of art, a way of talking about when you're a designer of interactive technologies or different, even, you know, physical three-dimensional technologies, that there's sort of a layer of experience design now as a sort of, you know, professional term. And that one really fascinates me because it's not just about design of objects or designs of even processes. It's like the design of the very range of experiences that a given individual is likely to have in a certain situation. Like, designing a roller coaster is all about producing these particular floods of experiences at certain points. But in thinking in terms of design seems a way of illuminating that, that sort of connection between material things, processes that we learn, and the actual, or not actual, just the experiences that come out of that, the very sight of consciousness, of play, of enjoyment.
It's like we're designing emotions now, and the objects or systems that support that are actually a bit secondary. You have to think about, well, what's the emotion someone would want? Now, here in the overdeveloped world, we don't need any more things, but we really lack feelings.
That's a beautiful way of thinking about it. And it's so subtle, and it can be, it's easy to be garish with that. And yet, you can feel it too, like if you go, like the whole, I'm fascinated by the yoga phenomenon, just because it's, on the one hand, so commodified, so integrated into how people balance their crazy, work lives with some need for, recollection, for embodiment, for energy, for spirit. And then watching how the commodification has developed over the last 10 years is really interesting, because it's so much about these very rare and in many ways wonderful kinds of affects of, you know, contentment, balance, compassionate opening, a sort of sense of connection with a larger flow. All of these things are really delightful and can be very generative, and you can sort of see the way there's sort of a space developing around what is essentially feeling, rather than something that's owned and operated. And there's something very close to that, to, you know, the kind of next level of design.
It connects to the situation's legacy a little bit too. So, you know, one of their motivating concerns is, what's a genuinely new emotion? You know, what would that mean? Can there be such a thing as a radical nostalgia? You know, for example, that's one that they did quite well. So those are challenges. And on the one hand, of course, people want to build businesses out of it. But on the other hand, we can build everyday lives out of, you know, what affect do we actually really want? And what would be the ambience and environment that would really create that together? Those seem to me to be still very contemporary questions.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying that concept. I mean, I'm even thinking just about it, because it also plays into how people imagine their connections. Like, what forms of group experience or group situations, collective situations, can be thought of in terms of the way that they generate feelings that you can't have in any other context. I mean, we're not just individuals having feelings in our inner subjectivity. Those feelings are shared. Affect spreads. You get on the bus and you can tune into some people, and then suddenly you're like carrying the thing. And there's this very strange, largely unnoticed kind of way in which affect transmits between different people in different kinds of situations. That in some ways I feel like we're just starting to get a real sense of what that would mean, and how you would play with it, particularly in an urban situation where there's so many people, there's so much going on.
And I mean, in to connect up to your opening remarks, you know, are there zones of affect that are opaque and vague enough that Facebook and Google just can't read them at all? You know, rather than just rail against the fact that they gather all our data, just accept that and think about, well, what territories left that they actually have no access to? Let's go up to that zone and work in that zone. Like, that seems like a contemporary project.
That's a wonderful way of framing it. I mean, and that to me strikes at what's so relevant about the Situationists and the Surrealists and any number of avant-garde practices, political or not, although they overlap, is that there is a creative movement towards something that is yet to be marked, yet to be brought into the grid, to be even explicitly stated. And I don't believe those places stop. Like, there's not a point where it's all locked in. It's just that they become perhaps much more subtle. They're on the edges of language. They're on the edges of the experiences we have with each other, or with the physical world, with nature. Like you say, it's a contemporary project to try to sneak up to those and see them as territories that are outside of the calculative grid of data. And sometimes I feel like with all of our concerns now, there's so much to fear and be concerned about and be angry about and try to even understand, that we forget that there is this other space that's on the edge of the spoken, on the edge of the known, that doesn't go away. You know, it's there. It's part of our potential.
Yeah, I mean, of course, one should probably be angry about some things some of the time, but you don't want to live your whole life there. You know, what's the other project where, okay, those are the given circumstances, I'm going to work in this direction. This is where I'm going to try and imagine and invent a new way of life in the terrain that's open. Because while certain, it feels like sometimes you're getting boxed in, where play is co-opted and this and that. But on the other hand, new territories also open up. So that's the other side of it. The internet might be there essentially so that a bunch of people can make money off it, but it just also leaves this space to play in as well.
So in your life now, either your research or your own, quote unquote private life, your life with your family, where are you sort of probing that space? Where do you feel some juice, some interesting thing opening up?
I did a little book based on a Kickstarter, because I wanted to know how those work, with Rachel Law, which we call Want. And the idea of that is weaponized adorables. And weaponized adorables negotiating tactics is what the Want stands for. Are there ways in which you can create masks, if you like, for your interactions with what the world of the internet offers, rather than try and retreat from it altogether, or try to have a private space because there really isn't one left. Could you think about ways that you sort of intentionally fashion, masks with which you engage with the sort of what the spectacle offers? So that was what that one was about. And you look around and you sort of see all sorts of crazy people on Tumblr, for example. Sort of crafting absolutely unclassifiable ways of being and modes of non-identity. They're not identities anymore. They're too kind of malleable to be called that. So that strikes me as kind of interesting terrain to try to, you need a new aesthetic to kind of grasp what folks are doing in those domains.
Yeah, the one thing I would say is particularly in that Tumblr space is there's something about the elliptical, the peripheral, the enigmatic, the sort of like almost the peripheral vision, the edge of peripheral vision, that there's something there that you can see, like the Tumblr's a great example when people collect objects and it goes beyond a constellation, it's not a museum, it's not a collage, it's something more diffuse. And yet the connection, the sense of specificity, the singularity that's invoked by those weird collections of things is quite interesting sometimes. I mean, it feels fresh and unnameable in a way. That's a good gesture. Well, I think we're actually wrapping it up here. So I really thanks for getting on the show, Ken, and what are you working on now? Is there a place that you can send people who want to find out more about your stuff?
Well, I'm easily Googleable. You just Google Mackenzie Walk, W-A-R-K. It's all out there. I have no secrets.
Well, wonderful. Well, thanks for being on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, from me, Eric Davis, to all you out there, keep your minds open.